Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the Carolina Panthers pass over local favorite Steve Wilks and choose Indianapolis Colts coach Frank Reich to be the team's new head coach. A jury decides in favor of the defendants in the civil trial brought by a former Myers Park High School student alleging CMS and the city failed to protect her. CMS seniors aren't meeting performance goals, and now the Education Law Center has assigned us a failing grade on public education funding. Details emerge about a pre-Christmas hit and run involving the North Carolina State Auditor, and the trial getting national attention because of the accused and of the bizarreness of the case begins in South Carolina. Here to talk about those stories and more is Steve Harrison, our political reporter here at WFAE News. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Nick Oxner is WBTV's chief investigative reporter and executive producer of Investigations Lear. Nick, good morning to you.
Hello, happy Friday.
Jonathan Lowe returns. He is education reporter at WSOC-TV. Jonathan, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Mike.
And Eric Spanberg is back with us. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Mike.
We're going to begin with an unfortunate story, a sad story, actually. Billy Packer, the voice of the NCAA men's basketball tournament, calling the Final Four for 35 consecutive years, has passed away. His family announced that last night. He died in Charlotte due to kidney failure. And his love of basketball, I guess, probably began before college, but he made a name for himself at Wake Forest and took the Demon Deacons to the several ACC titles in the 1962 Final Four. Then he segued to the broadcast booth. I can't remember a time without Billy Packer calling basketball games. When did he retire?
He retired in 2008, Mike, and you're right. For people who grew up in this part of the country, Billy Packer's every bit as well known for what he did on Raycom and Jefferson Pilot as what he did on CBS nationally. He was the voice of the ACC for many, many years, as well as the Final Four. And for, as I say, a couple generations of fans, he was synonymous with college basketball.
Yeah, I think he worked with Jim Thacker on Jefferson Pilot Sports. Billy Packer and Jim Thacker for a long, long time. But he distinguished himself with Jim Nantz and others at CBS. He worked for a while at NBC, but really on CBS for the Final Four because they kind of own that franchise over there. He's also written a number of books on basketball. Anything else you want to say about him before we move along?
The other thing was he was always forever dabbling in business. He loved real estate deals and all kinds of entrepreneurial ventures. So he was every bit as avid pursuing business as he was college basketball. So a full life and, as I say, synonymous with the game of college basketball, yeah, particularly in the Carolinas.
So Billy Packer, the voice of the NCAA basketball tournament, died last night here in Charlotte at the age of 82. That wasn't going to be our top story. Our top story was going to be the fact that the coaches have been decided, or the head coach of the Panthers has been decided. It wasn't Steve Wilks after all. It was Frank Reich, who happens to be the Panthers' first quarterback. I had no memory of this whatsoever. I think he played three games and then was replaced by my brother, Kerry. Kerry, for those of you who even remember Kerry Collins.
Throwback.
Well, he is now the team coach for our head coach for us, coming from the Indianapolis Colts. What else can you tell us about him?
Well, as you say, Frank Reich, everyone is making note of the fact that he was on the first Panther team, which was not a good team because they were a new team.
It was the first team, yeah.
That's right. They were 7-9, which wasn't bad for an expansion team. And he lived in Charlotte and did various things for several years after retiring from the NFL. He played 13 years. And then in 2006, he started his path up the NFL coaching ladder. And as you mentioned, Mike, he was 5 seasons as head coach of the Colts. That was his first head coaching job. He did have a winning record, 43-1. And the big conversation is where you started it, which is a lot of people wanted Steve Wilks because of the fact that he went 6-6 with a bad team, and he is a native Charlottean, and Steve Wilks is African-American, and the NFL is under a lot of scrutiny for its lack of diversity in hiring. So all of those things are part of this conversation as Frank Reich takes over the Carolina Panthers.
So what are there, two or three African-American coaches in the NFL, head coaches.
I believe we're at three right now out of 32 teams.
So he could have been the fourth, and we could have made a name for ourselves by doing that. What are the implications of not doing that? We had an opportunity to, and we chose another option.
It will be interesting to see. There was a racial discrimination suit filed last year by the former coach of the Miami Dolphins, Brian Flores. Steve Wilks is part of that suit. So you're going to hear a lot more about this. I think locally it's as much about the fact that he went 6-6 and that the players love him as the diversity aspect. So it's going to be a blend. Now, the thing about Frank Reich that I think probably helps him a lot is the Panthers have never had a coach with an offensive background. They've always gone with guys who came up through the defensive side of the ball, and you know, offense is what wins games in the NFL these days.
And one of the things that they say about Reich is that he's a player. He played for years in the NFL. He's coached for years in the NFL, and he has a relationship. He knows how to have a relationship with professional players, which is something that I think Matt Rhule struggled with, correct?
That is more than fair to say.
Okay, so Wilks was not the pick. When they made the announcement yesterday, I went on the Panthers' website and read some of the comments, and one of the people saying, hey, it should have been Wilks, called that a layup. Picking Wilks would have been a layup, mixing his metaphors, of course. have we heard, what has been the reaction to this around town, around it, amongst team members, et cetera?
I think it's the usual. I mean, there's a mix. There are people all over the place, every direction. But there is a strong sentiment for Steve Wilks deserving the job, deserving a shot. Another secondary story in this, Mike, is that when you have interim coaches like Steve Wilks, the hiring of African-American interim coaches as opposed to white interim coaches, there's a huge disparity there as well. So this is part of a national trend, national controversy. So I think it's going to fit into a larger storyline than just what the Panthers have done.
Yeah, I think that's why we saw. Go ahead. I was just going to say, I think that's why we saw Steve Wilks' attorney, as it relates to that point that Eric just made about the lawsuit that Brian Flores has. Steve Wilks' attorney was very quick to put out that. I mean, it was almost immediately after we learned the news of Frank Reich being named the head coach. Steve Wilks' attorney puts out that statement saying that they were, you know, deeply disturbed by this decision. You know, brought up that Steve Wilks was able to bring Panthers back into some sort of playoff contention. Certainly that this is going to continue, and this, in their eyes, adds to their case.
And David Tepper, who owns the team and whose decision is the final decision on this by right, because he owns the team, had a chance to look at other relatively successful head coaches and passed him up for Reich, who becomes the sixth full-time head coach of the Panthers, fired by Indianapolis after a 3-5-1 start. He left the regular season record with 40-33-1. That was his regular season record. How many times did he take that team or any team to the playoffs?
They went to the playoffs twice. I guess the other thing, probably obvious to anyone who's been watching Panthers football, but since David Tepper bought the team, they have not had a winning season. They have not gone to the playoffs, and their record is 29-53. So job one is to turn that around.
Well, and here's the interesting thing is Reich comes from the Colts, one team with a fairly hands-on owner, to the Panthers, another team with a very hands-on owner. We'll see if he can get along with this hands-on owner a little better than he did with the Colts owner.
I find it curious that there was no press conference yesterday to announce this. I don't think. I couldn't find it anywhere because I was going to pull audio from it, but I couldn't find it. So did they have a press conference about this?
No, but they will have one. Why not? Probably next week. It usually takes a few days after the hiring before they arrange that. So I would expect next week we'll hear from David Tepper and Frank Reich, and they will take questions.
So what has the Panthers organization said, aside from the fact that this is a guy? What have they said about their choice?
I mean, really, that's the announcement was all we got yesterday, and I have not seen anyone with any quotes, so I don't think anyone has been talking from the team side yet.
Okay, so until yesterday and that announcement about Frank Reich taking over as head coach, the big story of the week, I guess, here locally was the former Myers Park High School student who alleged that she was raped by another student in a wooded area back in 2015, the wooded area just off campus. And it just came to trial in the last few weeks as a civil suit that the student brought against CMS and the city, most specifically CMPD. You have been following this story literally for years, Nick, and I believe it was because of your reporting that a lot of this has come to light over the last couple of years. Last Friday, the jury decided in favor of the defendant, CMS. What has been the reaction from the plaintiff, her family, and the other young women who testified to similar incidents?
Yeah, well, I think obviously first some disappointment that that the jury found for CMS. However, within that disappointment, the verdict required the jury to reach four questions, and they had to get to all four yeses in order to find for the defendant. And if you got to no at any point, then you find for Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. And the first three of those questions were all yes. And among those questions, very key was whether or not the student was sexually harassed and whether or not that harassment was pervasive and serious. And they got to yes on those questions. And so after the trial, lawyers for the former student both said this was the first time anyone in a position of power, in this case the jury, had ever said, yes, Jane Doe, you were sexually assaulted in the woods. And so even amongst the disappointment, the message that her team was putting out was she has now been heard and believed, even if it didn't result in a verdict in her favor.
Jonathan, you were in the courtroom. The plaintiff, as Nick just said, was identified throughout the trial as Jane Doe, and she alleged that the CMS Board of Education had failed to protect her and put her in a situation to be further victimized, but the defendants painted a completely different picture. How did they portray their handling of all of this?
And, you know, that goes to the heart of this lawsuit and why this was on trial, was whether CMS and at one point the city of Charlotte were, quote, deliberately indifferent. And I think that the attorneys for CMS and the city of Charlotte tried to throughout the week show that they and their officials and their staff that responded to this did what was reasonable to address her concerns, the alleged assault, and then the follow-up afterwards. What we learned through the trial was that there were some questions and some contradictions, both from Jane Doe's parents and Jane Doe herself, about what they did or did not do in responding to CMS trying to investigate this alleged attack. And on the other side, you had Jane Doe and her parents saying that it seemed early on, right in moments afterward, that they had that the school officials had already made up their minds.
And prior to the jury taking this case into the jury room and coming back with a verdict, the judge in the case dismissed any allegations against the city or CMPD from this lawsuit. He just completely dismissed it. Why?
Well, what he actually did was issued a directed verdict, Mike. And what he said is that, and that ruling means that the plaintiffs did not present enough evidence that they could have reasonably had a chance of having a favorable verdict in their favor. It's interesting, having covered the story and knowing the evidence that is there, a lot of what I know to be in existence about how police handled this case was not introduced as evidence to the jury. So clearly there were evidentiary rulings from the court that kept a lot of information from the jury, but they found based on that, that there's no way the jury could find for the plaintiff.
And I have 15 seconds left. So could that dismissal of the charges against CMPD have influenced the jury in any way in the other side of this case with CMS?
Could be, and I do think we'll see an appeal, at least on that point.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more on this trial and other stories in just a moment. Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on 90.7. WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Steve Harrison from WFAE News, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Jonathan Lowe from WSOC-TV, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Let's go back to the jury's findings in this trial brought by a Jane Doe, former Myers Park High School student, against CMS for not protecting her and responding to her claims of rape that occurred during an incident in 2015. CMS, the jury's finding was that CMS did not act with deliberate indifference. The plaintiff had characterized the school system's handling of her complaint as having been deliberately indifferent. So is this decision then a verdict on how the school system handled the situation, essentially saying their approach was correct, or that Jane Doe's case, their side didn't make the case?
Deliberate indifference is a higher standard than negligence. So I don't know that anyone said this was good. It wasn't the high standard of deliberate indifference. Jonathan may have a different take on that.
So I was just going to say that I think what we have seen as far as a response to this has sort of already happened. CMS, the week before this trial even started, we had the first news conference from interim superintendent Crystal Hill. And anybody who knows that she came in as chief of staff last April. Part of her purview was Title IX. And during that news conference the week before, she spoke to a whole list. And as Nick even said during that news conference, it was the first time we had gotten anything of substance from anyone within CMS about changes that have been made to the Title IX office. And if you go through those changes, they added to the staff, they retrained faculty, staff, students on how to report, respond to, and investigate issues of sex harassment, discrimination, assault, et cetera. It was the first time, as Nick pointed out, that we had gotten that detail, and that was the week before. And so when you juxtapose that to what we learned during this trial, it's almost kind of like a silent admission by CMS that they realized that they had some issues when it came to Title IX.
And in fact, Laura Dunn, the lead counsel for the plaintiff, in a statement following the end of the trial, said, "We are not done fighting. Our client has been heard. And while the jury did not think that CMS's response had been deficient, we know the true impact on her and the other survivors who bravely spoke out in this matter. CMS had changed its policies and procedures since this litigation for the better, so it was worth her speaking out." Nick, as you mentioned a moment ago, there were things that you thought were omitted from this trial that you discovered during your investigations. Did anything surprise you?
I think maybe the most surprising piece of evidence the jury heard was the interview between Jane Doe and a detective from Charlotte Mecklenburg Police. I actually wasn't in the courtroom for that, it's surprising and important because of all of what I heard about that. I now have the recording. I got a copy of all the evidence. And so, I think looking and seeing, in the own words of police contemporaneously and of administrators, originally the judge would not let any of the evidence be public, entered into evidence in this trial. I fought for that and now have a copy of it. And I'm doing additional reporting so that to make sure the public will be able to see how this was handled in their own words and in their own actions by both police and administrators, and let the public decide for themselves if this is how we want our institutions handling cases where young teenage girls report being raped.
Jonathan. I thought it was very interesting, Mike, that while we heard from the former assistant principal at Myers Park, he was the last witness to be called. He was the only witness that the CMS attorney called. We did not hear from, we heard a lot of the name of the school resource officer that responded, but we did not hear from that. The jury did not hear from that person. So there was a lot said in court about that person's actions, about their interaction with Jane Doe, but we didn't see them in court. And so that's another thing that the attorney says could be an appeal point. Nick knows more about the legal logistics of all of that, but I would imagine that that would be a point that they could bring up as well.
I want to move on, but the other person we did not hear from was Mark Bosco, the principal at the time at Myers Park High School. They did enter into the record his deposition, but why would they not, somebody, even it, why wouldn't the plaintiff put him on the stand?
Well, they doing reading his deposition, it's evidence that they've already gotten, it's testimony they've already taken. And so functionally for the purpose of the trial, it is the same thing. Okay. And probably faster. The in federal court, the name of the game is speed. This is much faster and more efficient.
Although okay. I don't think it was a high point for the jury. I think they glazed over when those were read in court.
Agreed. Okay.
So moving on, it was reported this week that high school seniors in Charlotte Mecklenburg schools are far below the school board's goal for making sure that they are ready for life after graduation. This is yet another in a series of troubling reports about a lack of readiness that seemed to permeate the system. But district leaders in this case are now questioning what the numbers mean. What does that mean? The numbers are the numbers.
So this is, I mean, part of this is goals that Charlotte Mecklenburg, the school board, has set for itself. And so it's hard to know, you know, is this something real or is this kind of something phantom out there that they're chasing? But I mean, it goes, the district has been trying to this school year report on certain goals that they have and tracking that progress and keeping it in the public eye. This has to do with endorsements on high school diplomas.
And endorsements are recognition from the state that a graduate not only meets the minimum requirements, but has gone beyond to demonstrate readiness for career or college. Here are the numbers. Only 39%. Let me say that again. 39% of this year's seniors are expected to meet those criteria. The board's goal was 70% for this year, 75% for next year. And I know they have metrics that they use to determine readiness, but what does this mean to companies who might want to hire a graduate from CMS or colleges who might want to admit a graduate from CMS for the 61% who do not meet those standards?
I think it matters whether those colleges and whether those employers are taking into account the ACT and the SAT, because that is the point that was added into these endorsements. And so part of this has to do with during the pandemic, a lot of colleges suspended taking into account a student's SAT and ACT results. And so that's why during the board meeting on Tuesday, when they were discussing this, Interim Superintendent Hill said that basically, it's skewed because we're looking at the ACT and the SAT aren't really a good read on a student's abilities, and so as
they
far
aren't?
As whether they
then why have we been indulged? Why have we been taking these tests for 40, 50 years?
Well, I think so. You know, whether
sounds
a student,
like a cop out to
know,
me.
I don't know. I mean, if you don't do well on the SAT, does that mean that you will not be a good attorney? I don't know, or doctor or whatever. I think their point is that CMS is trying to build the holistic student. And so just the ACT and SAT should not be the only marker.
Holistically within the system, this is being repeated at almost every grade level. So how worried should we be?
Well, at 39%, and their goal is 70% this year and 75% next year. Mm-hmm. If you look at it that way, they're way off, and they have a lot of work to do. Will they make some changes or reevaluate how they are the metrics for these endorsements? Probably, with it being at 39%. I think anybody who looks at that, however you spin it, it's very low.
Meanwhile, CMS has been dealing with teacher and staff vacancies across the district, and their recently approved 2023-24 legislative agenda addresses some of that. It includes a request at all governmental levels for funds to make teaching here more attractive. Coincidentally, the Education Law Center graded how well all 50 states fund public education, and guess where we came in? 50th. Does that make us lower than Mississippi, for God's sake?
when you look at funding, how the state is funding public education, yes, it does.
Well, and the answer has to be, well, there are only 50 states, so that we have to be lower than Mississippi because of that. Is this a surprise, or have we been headed in this direction in terms of education funding for a while?
I mean, I think that's pretty evident in how you look at what's happened in, you know, state budgets over the last few years, that school districts have seen less and less when it comes to how much they receive from the state. And, you know, keep in mind that as it relates to CMS, the largest portion of funding that they receive is from the state, even though they receive money from local and federal partners. You know, the CMS is really focused on recruitment, retention, and fighting the winds that they see coming from the state as far as how much, you know, how much teachers are paid, whether or not they get master's pay, how what it takes to get their license. And you know, part of this legislative agenda deals with making it easier. If you move here from, if you've been a teacher for 25 years in New York, move here, it's like you're a beginner teacher.
Exactly. You spoke with some of the teachers about their experiences that could shed some light on the impact of what we just talked about, being 50th in terms of funding and how it might be viewed to prospective teachers coming here. Ray Legrone teaches art at CMS.
Right now, my biggest class is 33, but I teach six sections. So that's a lot of kids. And it's a lot of supplies. I teach art.
She goes on to say that the result is that CMS loses out on a lot of prospective teachers, but that is not the only reason.
They might have taught in New York for 25 years. They come down here and they're considered a beginning teacher.
And that's because of what's called license reciprocity, licensure reciprocity. Doctors don't get downgraded if they move from a practice in New York State to someplace in North Carolina. They may have to take an exam or something, but they don't get downgraded. They're still a doctor at the same level. Why do we downgrade teachers for moving?
Good question. I don't know. I'm new to relatively new to covering education, but it sounds like, you know, as you state there, that it seems unfair.
Mike, broadly, North Carolina and our licensing doesn't play mm-hmm. well with others. That applies to law licenses. We saw nursing licensing regulations change during the pandemic. And so what I would suspect, although I'm not an expert on teacher licensure, is that the teacher licensure is caught up in the exact same kind of lack of reciprocity that we see across other trades and industries across the country.
So in your reporting on this, Jonathan, you described CMS's legislative agenda as a robust list for a legislature at odds with the city of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County, the great state of Mecklenburg. CMS board member Stephanie Sneed.
Questions are often asked of board members, why don't we act in a particular way or more aggressive on matters such as teacher pay and retention efforts? We're often subjected to legislation that prevents us from making headways in these areas.
So what else is on the list that might help them make headway?
They've got a lot on the list.
Higher pay for teachers.
Higher pay for teachers. They want to make it so that school nurses, which this is really important, they want to allow certified nurses without a bachelor's degree to be employed. As you know, there are some schools that share school nurses, high schools especially, when you have, you know, thousands of students, they'll often share a nurse. And even down to school supplies, they want to provide teacher with some sort of stipend. It goes all the way into students. They want to the state to provide funding so that they can provide bus passes for CMS employees and students. As you know, we have a growing amount of in those two groups that are, you know, experiencing homelessness. Right. They want a technology and broadband expansion. I mean, it's across the board. And I think, you know, it's robust and ambitious and asking for these things from the state. But as we've seen in the past, there are the state and, you know, municipal governments here locally haven't always gotten along. And so I'm very interested to see how much of this they respond to. I reached out to the House Speaker and Senate President for a statement and still waiting to hear back.
Okay. Well, we'll see. We'll have to keep our eye on that as we go through the next couple of months. This is the week that the regional Fed president called Charlotte's economy a shining light. But at the same time, Mecklenburg County commissioners got a mixed report on the state of the economy in Mecklenburg County during their annual budget retreat. Why the mixed message? Things are great. Things ain't so good.
I think it's all in the eye of the beholder in a way. You know, I mean, they went into some of the familiar topics that we talk about, the increasing price of rent for apartments, about $1,500 a month in Charlotte. The fact that average home sale prices had gone up 10% in the past year to over $500,000. And so when you take that and when you couple it with inflation and you couple it with an anticipated recession, it is a mixed bag. What North Carolina and Charlotte have going for them is continuing population growth, which spurs the economy in many different ways.
Well, we were speculating a couple of weeks ago that we may already be in a recession and don't know it. And yet the numbers came out yesterday and we are clearly not in a recession. Growth is up and so is consumer spending. At that budget retreat, consumers heard from the county's chief economist, Brandon Simmons, who told them that retail sales remain strong. That means sales tax collections are up along with rent and housing prices and wages, but that our population grew at its slowest rate since 1975. That actually may come not only as a shock and surprise to some people, but as a good sign, because we're getting a little congested up in here. And with uncertainty in the economy at large, he said turbulent times may be ahead.
Overall economic activity will weaken, and around the middle of the year, possibly heading into a mild recession or a zero growth scenario. And then we might see a slight correction with home prices this year.
So he means a drop in home prices. Why are they saying this? They've been saying this now for months, and it's not happening.
They are economists. Remember that. Economists' batting averages are not very high. But I think one of the things that really stands out about this, Mike, is assuming that they are on the right track, that we're headed for a recession in the second half of the year, you have to be thinking about that at all levels, whether it's government or your business, because those tax collections and revenues that are above average right now are about to take a dip. And so that's what they're going to be grappling with, they being the county commissioners, as they try to put together this next budget.
Steve.
And Mike, I wanted to say, I mean, one thing from this county presentation this week that I thought was really interesting was, you know, all this data they talked about, home prices and things like that, that the percent of people who own their homes mm-hmm. has gone up since 2019. It was about 58%. Now it's about 60%. I just think that's kind of fascinating because we've heard so much about this affordability problem. Not saying it's not real, but people are buying homes.
Yeah,
that was an interesting stat. Go ahead, Mike. Yeah,
there's more to say about this, and there's some reaction to the falling, the prospect, well, it's actually happening, the decrease in value of some homes. They're coming down slightly after hitting all-time highs, and we'll get some reaction from George Dunlap, the chair of the county commission, to that, which is also surprising. We'll talk about that. We're here on the Local News Roundup, which will continue in moments. Stay with us on 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. It's the Local News Roundup. That's why Steve Harrison is here from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, Jonathan Lowe from WSOC-TV, and Nick Oxner, Chief Investigative Reporter from WBTV. So, the county's chief economist, Brandon Simmons, spoke about median household income rising in Mecklenburg County. It rose 7% over the last 2 years. I think that beats or just about beats the rate of inflation in the recent years. Was it 8% inflation?
9% was the peak in June. Well, it's still above 6 right now.
Okay, well, we're kind of keeping up. We're in there. But that means that the household income rose to about $73,000, median household income rose to about $73,000. But that did not calm the fears of County Commissioner Laura Meyer about the rising price of everything and its impact on economic inequality.
To me, it's like watching a car wreck in slow motion. You've got wages aren't keeping up. We're watching it become worse.
But wages went up 7%. So what is she talking about?
Well, about 7% over 2 years compared to the inflation that we've had, those are unequal.
Okay.
That's what she's talking about. The other thing is, Mike, real quick, you want to play the Dunlap? We can come back to the housing after Dunlap.
No, go ahead. No, that's all right. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, it's interesting that the stat that Steve mentioned, the 60% versus 58% for home ownership, is certainly notable. And the fact that home prices are starting to come down a little bit. But I think you also have to keep in mind that the cost burdened homeowners and renters, that continues to increase. And that is, if you're spending 30% or more of your income on mortgage, rent, and utilities, and that is a big problem that no one's been able to solve yet.
Yeah, home prices, though, are declining slightly. They've been declining for a while as the market cools because of rising interest rates. Homes are now staying on the market for an average of about 42 days. And Commission Chair George Dunlap is pleased with that.
I think it's good. Some people may not think so, that the time on the market for houses has increased. And the reason I say that is because that will in turn bring down the cost of housing for our community. Maybe more people who have houses on the market would be willing to sell for less, which makes home ownership more obtainable.
I know there are two sides to every coin, but if housing is the average person's largest investment, why would you be pleased if that investment loses money?
I see where he's going with this, that, you know, lower prices, maybe more people, but it really doesn't add up, because the big problem with the housing market, of course, one of the big problems is that mortgage rates are high. And so that's why people are not buying houses at the same rate.
I think, Mike, if you're a city council member or county commissioner, you're up there on the dais and people come to speak to you about their problems. The people who come, kind of the squeaky wheels on this issue, are the people who are trying to buy their home, of course, and they're priced out. You know, I mean, they just do not hear from people who say, my home has gone from $700,000 in value to $620,000 and I'm furious about it. I mean, that sentiment exists, but they do not hear about it. And so they do respond to the people who were kind of in their ear, and that is people who are trying to buy their first home.
And the county makes money on houses going up because of property taxes. And that's one of the things they're looking at in this retreat. It's a $2.2 billion plus budget, and they were expected to get a property tax revaluation update because this will go into effect later this year. What did commissioners hear about the revaluation and the prospect for taxes, property taxes, rising?
I did not hear the presentation on the revaluation. I know you're right that we're doing one 4 years instead of 8 years, and that that we will know the rates later this year. I guess the tax bills will come out in July, but I don't know the specific update. I don't know if Jonathan or anyone else heard it.
The county, the county, at 2019 for the last reval, they did not go revenue neutral while the city did. What I'm hearing, the city is going to do its kind of budget or its overview next week. I'm hearing there's been some chatter that the city manager, I don't know if it's going to happen, but that the city manager has been exploring a tax increase on the city side. That may not happen, but there's certainly some chatter there that taxes could go up.
And they're worried about a recession and they want to raise taxes?
That will be, I assume, part of the debate, yes.
Okay, one of the key things that Mecklenburg County Health Director Raynard Washington told commissioners that they should do is to advocate for Medicaid expansion. The state has been reluctant over the years to take advantage of this. The federal government funds this, but now that roadblock seems to be weakening, if expansion were to take place, how many more Mecklenburg County residents would get access to health care they don't have access to now?
So I think the numbers are, if Medicaid is expanded, it would cover 600,000 additional people in the state of North Carolina. In Mecklenburg County, there are roughly 124,000 adults without medical insurance coverage, and about half of them would be covered by the expanded Medicaid program. That is what the commissioners heard this week.
Okay. For nearly a month, the owner of a car damaged by another car that had driven up on its hood tried to find the driver who left their car up on the hood behind, empty, gone. It turns out that person was State Auditor Beth Woods. She was driving a state vehicle at the time with a single-digit license plate number. Why was it so difficult to find out who was driving that car, Nick?
Boy, isn't that the question? Isn't that the question? And it is remarkable that this had stayed as quiet, or not as quiet, it stayed silent as it did for more than a month until Lucille Sherman of Axios Rally broke the story last week. Unique one, because Beth Wood was driving her, all the members of the Council of State have a license plate with a number on it. Hers is, I believe, 8, and that license plate is affixed to a state-owned vehicle. What we've been able to piece together collectively using video and photos is that she, and as we know from her own statement, she left a Christmas party in downtown Raleigh, got in her car, somehow ended up in her car on top of another car, and then left the scene and ushered back in to a nearby office. And so she's charged with leaving the scene of an accident.
Yeah, she says she's made a serious mistake and that she regrets her decision to leave the scene. She did tell State Motor Fleet Management the very next morning, and police cited her for unsafe movement and for failing to provide her name and information to the owner of the car. But that was back on December 8th and 9th, and this is just now coming to light. The North Carolina Republican Party, not top Republicans in the legislature, but the party, has called for her to resign. She's a Democrat. She has resisted those calls so far and won't go to court until March 23rd. Is she likely to have to resign before or after the disposition of that case?
The only mechanism to get her to resign would be, I think you could be impeached and removed from office, but I don't see that functionally happening, especially not with this charge. The interesting thing, though, here is that Beth Wood is generally a state auditor. Her job is to uncover wrongdoing and keep people accountable in state and local government across North Carolina. And generally, she does that. She has a very good reputation for being above board. And so the fact that she was at the center of a thing, of a cover-up, we didn't know about it for more than a month. And she knew about it. Obviously, she was there. The Cooper administration knew about it because it's the Department of Administration, a Cooper cabinet agency that administers the motor pool and that state car is owned by. And yet nobody who knew about this came forward to notify the public. And it has been just painstakingly slow in getting any details. That statement you read from Beth Wood came about a week after the story first broke.
So I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because, Eric, you're going to be doing a whole hour on this program on Monday, and that is the beginning of a tragic and bizarre trial or a case that went to trial in Colleton County, South Carolina, involving a prominent lawyer from a legal family that has played a major role in that state's justice system for a century. Alec Murdoch is accused of murdering his wife and son, but that's not all. He's facing 100 other charges. But is this trial just about the murder charges?
Yes. Yes, this is about the murder charges. As you say, there are all kinds of tentacles about other deaths that are being, reinvestigated, insurance fraud. It kind of goes on and on. It's beyond John Grisham's wildest imagination.
Yeah, you couldn't write a believable work of fiction that includes all of these charges in here. The trial is underway. Jury selection took place this week. Opening arguments took place, I think, yesterday. And they had to take down the portrait of Alec Murdoch's grandfather, which hangs in the very courtroom where this trial is taking place.
That family ran the prosecutor's office for nearly a century. So they have connections and power all through that part of South Carolina. And those connections and that lineage is very much a part of this story that we're hearing.
And we'll hear about it on Monday on this program at 9. We talked a lot last year about the congressional maps drawn by the legislature that favored the GOP in 10 or 14 states here in North Carolina. Those maps were thrown out by the court. State Republicans drew another map. The court rejected those two. A 3-judge panel then appointed a 3-special master group to draw new maps that we eventually used when we went to the polls in November. But recently, Steve, you sat down with one of the map drawers of that three special master panel, former state Supreme Court Justice Bob Orr, to talk about what went on behind closed doors during that process. What went on?
Yeah, so Bob Orr is interesting. He is a used to be on the North Carolina Supreme Court, a Republican for his whole life. And then during Trump, he left the party. And when he drew this map that was you know, kind of favorable to Democrats. They have seven seats. Republicans have seven. A lot of Republicans criticized him for that, feeling that he put his thumb on the scales for Democrats. He said, look, no, we had no opportunity to do that. We were simply following the Supreme Court's orders. And we talked a lot about, you know, Mike, you mentioned that second map had four competitive seats in North Carolina, which was arguably a good thing. And Bob Orr, you know, said, well, that is probably a good thing. And in a way that, but he wasn't allowed to draw competitive seats. He was following these very strict orders from the court to have a balanced map. And he, even if they wanted to have competitive seats, they just couldn't do it.
And as soon as these maps were released, the ones that we used to vote on in November, they were criticized by Republicans. The conservative John Locke Foundation wrote that, quote, Bob Orr put his thumb on the scale for congressional Democrats. Now, he's a former Republican, now an independent. Why that charge? Did he put his thumb on the scale? And did he have a response to that accusation?
So, yes, he says he did not. And again, he goes back to this idea, like, we had this very strict order from the court. We had to draw essentially a balanced map. He says, you know, there was a feeling among Republicans that he drew a favorable seat for Jeff Jackson. He says, absolutely not. I did not do that. But yeah, I mean, it kind of goes, the history of this goes back to that he was a Republican for his whole life and he left the party, and that there are a lot of hard feelings about that, that not only did he leave, but that he's been very critical of today's Republican Party.
So you spent a lot of time late last year looking at CATS and how it's been operating post-pandemic, and you also spent some time recently talking to Brent Cagle, who has taken charge of CATS on an interim basis. As a driver's strike looms large, how worried is he about that potential strike, and what concerns him the most about the prospect?
Well, I think Eric can pivot on this one, because Eric, you spoke to Cagle directly about the strike, right?
Well, I'm sorry, it is Eric. Excuse
me. Oh, no, it's okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I did. I was asking him, as is our way with the Business Journal, what's the financial implication? And he started by saying that the biggest worry, of course, is what this does to the customers. They can't go to work. They can't get to doctor's appointments. They're dissatisfied, obviously, with CATS if this happens. But he said financially, it's not really a big deal. He said that's not anywhere near his primary concern. Revenue-wise, it's about 10% of revenue is all fares with CATS. And remember, the light rail, for example, would not stop running if there is a strike. And light rail ridership is similar daily to the buses. So the money is the one aspect that they're not worried about. Everything else they are worried about.
Meanwhile, everybody's making spending decisions on what to do with the last of the COVID relief money that came from the federal government during the pandemic. The county commission this week unanimously voted to spend $99.6 million in the American Rescue Plan Act funds on affordable housing and homelessness, behavioral health and health equity, child care and early childhood development, parks, environment and infrastructure, and workforce and economic development. And CATS has also allocated their relief funds. I think they have $202 million in funds. How are they going to use that money?
So CATS has about $135 million left that they haven't spent. I think the most interesting thing that came out of the rundown of what they're doing is that $50 million of the money is going to be used to tear down 20 of the light rail cars, essentially, you know, all the way and rebuild them. And that's called midlife maintenance, extreme maintenance, I guess, is how they refer to it. So that is a big expense that CATS avoids in a way by using some of this federal recovery money. And I think the other things you said, Mike, about Mecklenburg County, it shows how the health disparities that were, exacerbated and exaggerated by COVID, how that's reflected in the spending that you're now seeing.
And is that how that money was intended to be used when the government sent it to us?
I mean, yes, in a way, you know, dealing with some of those health disparities, yes.
So we began the program talking about the selection of Frank Reich as new head coach of the Panthers, and thanks to Jonathan Lowe forwarding me a tweet. We're going to end with this conversation with Steve Wilkes. He tweeted this out this morning. The sun rose this morning, and by the grace of God, so did I. I'm disappointed but not defeated. Many people aren't built for this, but I know what it means to persevere and see it through. It was an honor for me to coach those men in the Carolina Panthers locker room as the interim head coach. Players, coaches, and staff, thank you for your hard work and dedication. I took pride in representing Charlotte, a great city that I love so much. Thank you to my family, friends, and the community for your overwhelming support. I do wish Frank Reich all the best. I will always be a fan of the Carolina Panthers football team. That's Steve Wilks in a tweet this morning about his not being selected as head coach. Steve Harrison from WFAE, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Jonathan Lowe from WSOC, and Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.